So going back to Formula D up in Connecticut, I got to tell you, the one thing that I found to be awesome was the amount of American cars that are still participating in Formula D. I know going back, there's like the lineage of like Justin Pollock and obviously the RTR guys are all running it, Vaughn and all them. There's obviously been muscle cars, but to see, you know, C5s through C7 Corvettes out there, you know, Madfield really brought that chassis into Formula D. I feel like made it really popular. And now seeing these other guys come up and doing a lot with them, it's really cool. I'm excited to see that happening more because I feel like there was this point in time where only boomers drove Corvettes. Like that was the mentality. Yeah, you know, only guys with the New Balances and the white socks. And I feel like with the drift guys picking up, we're getting kind of cool again. Like the Corvette's becoming acceptable that it's not just the guy in the ankle high socks. I am an old man. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's cool. You see more of that now. I mean, if you ask Corvette owners, I'm sure they'll tell you that they were always cool, right? They never went out of style or anything like that. But I think what you're getting at is for sort of the younger drift generation, they're really latching onto those vehicles now, probably more than ever. What I'm seeing too is it seems like the younger generation now is really in tune with the muscle car stuff. Like, and I you can argue like, you know, Mustang, it's not really a muscle car, you know, there's all the little fine lines and stuff, but in general, bigger engine American vehicles is what I'm referring to.
Yep.
And it seems like there's such a big push for that now with the younger generation. I wonder if you're like a 17, 18 year old and you're starting to think about, you know, getting into cars, maybe you got some friends that have a couple of fixed up cars, lowered wheels, whatever. There's definitely a draw to those vehicles that already have a ton of torque and a ton of horsepower right out of the box as compared to when you were younger, right? Mm-hmm. And you had friends maybe that might have had like an SR20 something, you know, maybe they had a swap Sentra or 240 or whatever it is. And it was making, let's say, you know, 250-ish horsepower. That was a big deal at that time.
I mean, to be fair, the SN95 barely made 250 horsepower. So that's the funny part is I grew up in a Mustang household. So
you did? Okay.
Yeah. My adoptive brother had a SN95 4.6 liter, you know, the whole nine. And it was a cool car. But by today's standards, I mean, they were slow. You know, and these new cars that are coming out, as you said, are making 450 horsepower.
Yeah. I mean, if you compare, because if you're getting into, let's say you're starting to really notice the drift stuff, you see like S chassis, you see, you know, 350Z, stuff like that, out of the box compared to the muscle cars, they're not very impressive because people are looking just at the power numbers. Yeah. Like, well, this one makes, you know, almost double the horsepower. There's definitely a draw there, I think. And that could be why we're seeing such an uptick now with the younger guys kind of getting into it. And maybe that's why we're seeing all the stuff with the takeovers and stuff as well, because you have all that torque, you can do your burnouts, you can do your donuts and hit people and, you know, all the stuff you like doing.
Yeah. I mean, know? The thing is like, as I said, with growing up down in Virginia, we had a very big domestic car scene, obviously.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're right. The Corvettes for the Corvette guys never went out of style as far as, you know, they were still into them. But as far as like, could this be the next car that people are looking at as the go-to drift chassis? Kind of like how the 240 had its time, how the 350Z sure. had its time, and then E36. Like, there's a lot of potential in both the older Mustangs, the, you know, like the 197s, and then getting into the S550s. Both of those have a ton of potential. It's just the cost that's the one limiting factor right now. So if the cost starts to come down when you're getting your second and third owners, the potential to get one, you know, either salvage title and build a race car out of it or even get one that has a blown engine, put something else in it, it's becoming a lot more accessible for people. I think that's also why we're seeing an uptick in it.
Yeah. If you're putting together a drift specific vehicle, chances are you're going to be using a V8, right? These days. That's the majority of vehicles out there have those engines. So, you know, I could see a lot more, even like older Mustangs getting like an older, like, what do you call them? Like notchbacks or Fox bodies, those types.
Fox bodies, yeah.
And then putting the current, you know, whatever, you know, LS or whatever engine you think is gonna do the right thing.
So funny enough, Max put this in. Chelsea Denofa has a awesome Mustang that's actually running an EcoBoost 4-cylinder, and that thing is incredible.
That's cool.
Incredible drift car. It's absolutely a killer platform. So that one's definitely one to check out. And that's also the funny thing. So you're seeing some of these guys that are starting out with the 4-cylinder EcoBoost Mustang, throwing it around at their local small drift events and all that, and then graduating into the V8 cars or going with a different chassis eventually down the road. But it's a good jumping off point because they still have something that's rear wheel drive that can get the RPM up to get the wheel speed up and be able to mm-hmm. to make some smoke, and it's working out for them, you know. And I think it's hard to find a car besides a BRZ, and even the BRZ or GR86, so on and so forth, to find something that out the box will be able to provide that at that level, you know, for that cost, let's say. Because I feel like if you go out there and start drifting a stock BRZ, it's great, but you're not going to have that same amount of power that you could get out of the EcoBoost by just turning up the boost.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe it's a changing of the guard. It does feel like previously, if you were going to be getting into the drift world, you were going to get an S chassis or maybe A86, like an old school one, and then, you know, start from there. You'll start gradually building power, and that was kind of the starting point. But now you could get, you know, into something pretty affordable, some American Muscle, and then you're kind of in the mix already, right? In terms of power levels and what you need. I would imagine it'd be a steep learning curve if you're just getting into it and you're starting with this huge motor and a ton of torque. You got to sort of like figure out how to tame that. But that's probably part of the challenge, and that's part of the fun of it, I would imagine. I've never been into drift, like, you know, I've never done it myself, so I couldn't tell you. But just from the outside looking at it, it seems like that would be a fun part of the progression. It's like figuring out how to not overcook it and put it into a wall. Part of the fun is figuring out, like, that's the challenge of it, right?
And we know Mustangs like to find curbs and walls. Yeah. So that's definitely
not me.
Listen, I'm a Mustang fan, so if I'm the one saying it, it's true. Anyway, moving on. but
yeah, I do notice, like you mentioned earlier, there are a lot more out there now. And, you know, when I go to, like, even just if I have a little bit of time, I'll stop by Cars and Coffee or something. And there are a lot of young people that are, you know, in the Corvettes and in the Mustangs and even like the, you know, like the Chargers and stuff. And there's the kids that have, you know, been doing it for a little bit with the Hellcats and stuff like that. So I've seen a lot more of that now than I did, say, like, I don't know, 5 years ago when it was all 240s and Zs. You know?
So question for you. Have you seen the new 6-pack Charger, the one that has the...
Yes.
What do you think about it?
I mean, I've never driven anything like that, so I can't really comment on how that is. I do like, overall, the fact that American companies are, like, really pushing hard for just the muscle thing, like, because without that, I feel like there's a huge chunk of Americana that's sort of missing. And I think for years, like, it was frowned upon, right? Because everyone's talking about gas mileage, and the whole world seemed like they were all pushing toward EV, and now that's sort of slowed up a little bit. But there's still companies like Dodge out there willing to, like, put it all out there, put it on the line, and put some really, really powerful stuff. Sometimes I think it's too much. But then when I look at, like, the plaid Teslas, I'm like, that's kind of too much also. You know, I would hate to put that type of a vehicle into a new driver's hands and then hope that nothing happens. You know what I mean? That part does worry me a little bit because, man, like, you know, those things are monsters.
And yeah, it's like, definitely not a new driver car. No, definitely driving on a harder level. Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of kids out there that have parents that will purchase, like a plaid, for example, and they borrow the car to go, you know, McDonald's or something or Starbucks or whatever. And it's like, it's so much power. You know what I mean? It's so much responsibility. It worries me a little bit.
Yeah. You know? No, I mean, I can agree with you. As the power level has kind of come up for the daily driver, let's say.
Crazy.
It's kind of unprecedented. You know, look, it's the trade-off of the cars have gotten safer. You know, the cars have gotten faster. Yeah. They've gotten safer. And it's kind of that false sense of security where it's like, oh, the car is safer so they can go a little faster and it won't be as dangerous. But yet we're sitting here in a tin can from the 90s hoping for the best. You know,
I'm telling you when I'm in one of my project cars and I'm driving, I like head on a swivel. I get a little nervous just because if that thing gets hit, the safety equipment and you know, from a 1992 Honda is, it's not great, right? Compared to, you know, what you have cars, now. Yeah. So it's definitely, it's a little worrisome.
Yeah. I was going to say, I have my head on a swivel here constantly. I mean, driving in New York is a challenge in itself. So even in my, my little 09G, I'm sitting there like this. Constantly looking around, it gets a little dicey out here sometimes, and I it's the same thing. Like I don't have the same amount of like the sensors and all that. That, you know, oh, you got somebody coming into your lane. Let me, you know, my wife's truck will avoid the accident or apply the brake. My little car's not doing that. I'm done. Like if somebody's in my lane, it's over. Like
it's the same. We have a like a Kia family car or little van thing, and like it's got sensors everywhere. You know, so even if I'm just driving and maybe I take one of my hands off the wheel, it'll kind of give you a warning, like both hands on the wheel. I'm like, whoa, take it easy.
Yep.
You know, I think there, I was parallel parked. I was trying to pull out as a vehicle was passing. It wouldn't let me go because it sensed there was a vehicle there, but there was room. It wouldn't let me go though. And I was like, I can't even pull. I can't go right now. The car's completely, you know,
well, let me halted, do anything. So. That's the downside. But I mean, I guess there's a good thing about being able to at least have some power when you do want it then. But the one thing that I did kind of want to also touch on, it's not just drift though. I'm seeing it. So we've been getting a lot more clients that are, or drivers that are coming out of, you know, grid life, and they're getting into the NASA level events and so on and so forth. And they're all starting to gravitate to these platforms. Like I'm seeing more and more of it, more work with the a lot of the second owner, third owner Mustangs are becoming very popular, and I think that there's a ton of potential with that car. You know, it has really good brake potential. There's a lot of guys that those cars came with like a whole Brembo brake package on them. You know, you had Bilstein suspension on a lot of them, and 500 horsepower. I mean, can you really, what else do you need to get out there and start to enjoy a car, whether it be on the back roads, whether it be a little bit of drag racing, whatever it is, like it's a great starting point.
Yeah. And it's funny. You mentioned like with the fact that it has great brakes and this upgraded suspension, it's almost like they intended that car to actually take turns and not just go in a straight line like everyone assumes. Right. It's funny because whenever I see, you know, having come from the media world, whenever I see comparisons of vehicles, like let's say the Civic Type R, GR Corolla, you mentioned the BRZ, vehicles like that, they're always testing 0-60. It's always quarter mile time or 8 mile time, either one. Rarely is it how does it handle on, you know, road racing or, you know, in a time attack scenario. It's always straight line performance, how fast you get from A to B. And then those numbers get put out online or in print or whatever it is, and then people on social media are constantly like, well, you know, the Civic Type R, it's going to get smoked by the GR Corolla because it has a better, you know, quarter mile time or, you know, or whatever comparison you want to make. And it's silly because, you know, those vehicles weren't even meant to go in a straight line quickly. That wasn't their intended purpose, right? So I wonder how many of those vehicles like that you mentioned before, like some of the Corvettes and the Mustangs, really had a lot of potential to do really, really well in a competitive, let's say, time attack environment with just a few mods, but everyone gets those things and they just want to drag race them or they want to street race them.
Yes.
There's so much more out there. And, you know, I think with some of the modern stuff like the Hellcats and stuff, those are a little more intended for straight line performance. Yeah. You're not going to get a whole lot of handling out of those. They're not meant to do that. But it's always interesting how in America, everyone's so obsessed with the power number and the quarter mile time, you kind of lose sight of some of those other benefits you can get from a vehicle like that's got great suspension, great brakes. It's very balanced, you know, whether it be Japanese or American.
I feel like people forget that the Mustang and the Corvette competed in like auto racing for, you know, literally 50 years. Yeah. You know, they these cars were not designed just to go in a straight line. And the engineers...
Well, we just talked about the Mark IV Super. We just talked about that recently. Yeah. That's a grand touring car. Like,
yeah, everyone exactly. Says
they put the beadlocks in the back and the huge turbo and you know, and yep. Set it down the strip. But they also are supposed to be excellent handling vehicles that you can yep. throw around a little bit, you know, even though I feel that car is rather large for its era. Still, that's you know, yep. That was the intention.
But that
they just got kind of skipped, you know?
Yeah, but that was that whole, you know, what was it? It was SCCA back in the day when they were hosting the events, and you had these like door-to-door racing between the Camaro, yeah. The Mustang, you know, they were out there actually doing it, and it was great.
Right.
And I mean, let's be honest, if you looked at like back then, it was an IROC versus a notchback Mustang, and it was crazy because that IROC, the street car, you would never think that thing could take turns.
It was ripping, all right.
Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, it was meant to be a car that could get out there and do track work if it had to. But people never thought of it that way. It was always just a stoplight car or something like that. And I think people didn't realize that these cars had potential to do different motorsports than just, you know, drag racing.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's been this way for decades. The hot rod mentality is a very American thing. And so proving what your vehicle can do from, you know, from a dead stop to that next stoplight or something, you know, in that realm seems to just, it's always been the biggest draw. So if you have a company like, let's say, like Dodge, and they have, you know, some new muscle car coming out, and they state these crazy, these wild 0-60 numbers, the way that Musk does with the Teslas and stuff like that, it draws in more attention, and it gets, I think, way more viral than if you just talk about, oh man, that, trust me, this thing handles incredibly well.
Oh no, don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, the Demon 170.
There's a very small group of people. Yeah. There's a very small group of people that are like, how well does it handle? I want to see. It's a much larger audience is going, well, that'll outrun this vehicle. That's faster than that vehicle.
The Demon 170 is a prime example. That whole marketing campaign was all based around drag times, how fast it could go. And then, you know, you could get the Demon where they, you know, you got it without the passenger seat, and you got it with, you know, whatever. So there was a whole bunch of that. Dodge.
That was smart, though. That was very smart marketing, because they knew exactly who their audience was. And I don't know who ran that marketing, you know, campaign, or who the guy or girl was, but they were smart. They zeroed in on exactly the right type of buyer, and people love those vehicles, you know, and a lot of people do drag race those vehicles, and that's what they got them for.
Yeah.
You know? And that's completely understandable. But I think, like, when you look at, you know, the Civic Type R, for example, people are always looking at how much power does it make. Well, it makes 300 and whatever horsepower. Is that enough to compare to this vehicle or that vehicle? But you're missing the point. That vehicle handles incredibly well. It brakes incredibly well. But that gets skipped over a lot, though.
Yeah.
Everyone's just looking at what's the 0-60 on that one, you know, and what's the quarter mile time.
Which is crazy, because you don't see as many of the FL5 and FK8 generations competing at a drag race level, like you see I'm just saying in general, but I'm saying, like, to look at the quarter mile time and to look at drag times for a car that is going to be massively underutilized in that discipline is pointless.
Right.
And that, I think that's what you're alluding to. I just was kind of saying, like, now that I'm thinking about it, you know, back, you know, between the older Civics, the whole thing was the power to weight ratio. You could get 600 horsepower in a, you know, 1500 pound chassis, and you're going to sail down the track. And I think there's been a big limiting factor where Honda doesn't have that to fall back on anymore. So now it has to be that type of handling. It has to be able to outperform everything in its class. 'Cause then what's the selling point?
Yeah. I think you have to also remember, you know, when Honda designed like the CRX, the Civic, and Del Sol, all those vehicles, you know, they were making peppy commuter cars.
Yep.
And, you know, they would have an SI model that would be even peppier, right? And then, of course, the Type R and stuff came along later, and, you know, overseas. But the surprise thing about that was I don't think they ever expected these kids at home to start hopping them up and, like, you know, pulling off the airbox and, you know, and then, wait, this Integra engine will fit inside the Civic, you know, chest cavity. This is insane. So it sort of took on a life of its own. And I think there was something within that of, like, buying a low dollar, low buck vehicle and then putting, you know, some time and some money into it, and then it turns into something that can beat a Mustang perhaps on a racetrack or, you know, on the street. So that's a little bit different. I think nowadays everything comes with a decent amount of power, from the Civic Type R to Dodge, you know, all the Hellcats and stuff like that. You definitely have a target on your back if you've got a Hellcat or something, because people know that it's supposed to be the fastest one, right? And you certainly have all the attention you could ever want if that's your thing. You're not flying under the radar with that vehicle, you know. It's certainly a very specific type of individual that would want that type of vehicle. Or, you know, we're talking about vehicles being used for specifically for drag or road race or whatever. When it comes to some people, they just want the best of what they can get. They can afford the top model, right? It has the most power. It has the best suspension, the best brakes, the best everything. And they just get it. And they just daily drive it. Maybe they just drive it on the weekends. They don't do any type of motorsport at all. They just want it because it's the best. They've worked to a point where they can afford it. They're going to buy the best. And maybe they do that with everything, right? So there's definitely that group as well. But it is interesting, though, to see now so many young people sort of latching on to the V8 stuff, whereas I'm not used to that, because when I was younger, everyone wanted Japanese cars, at least where I lived. That was, you know, what everyone was after. They were affordable. You know, they were affordable. You could sort of like tinker with them, you know, paycheck by paycheck and build them up. Not to say you can't do that with a Corvette, too, but getting into a Corvette at that time was really, really difficult, I think, for most people.
I mean, that's the big difference is that, like, now you can get into a Corvette for, you know, $10,000. You couldn't do that, you know, you couldn't do that before. Like, and I'm not saying just like an automatic Corvette. I'm saying you can find a decent, I was looking before just because I knew we were going to talk about this. I was like, let me just go poke around. You can find stuff out there. Like, it might not be exactly what you want, but if you're using it for a track build or whatever, does it really have to be everything you want? No. You know, and that's the good thing. So I was like, this is doable, you know, and that's what's really, I think, is going to be the one determining factor on how much this catches on, is really what it's going to come down to is cost. If you're able to get the cars down to that sub $10,000 mark, and people are able to get what they want out of them, that's all we're going to need. And everyone's going to start picking, you know, I'm not saying everyone, there's going to be a lot more adoption of that platform in the not just drag racing world, not just the straight line world. You're going to see more. I feel like we're going to see more and more of it in drift, and we're definitely going to see more of it in auto racing.
And isn't it interesting how the parallels run, whether you're thinking about getting a Mustang and or whatever car, maybe it's a Mustang, Corvette, whatever, you can get a decent chassis, maybe something without an engine or transmission, and then go to a gen car and get an LS for very, very cheap, right? Put it together, throw it in, you're good to go. On the other side, you can also find an old Civic or Integra for pretty cheap nowadays. And you can go to the junkyard and get a K24 for very, very cheap, put everything together and throw it in there. Either way, you can build a decent car for I don't know, let's say under 25 grand, right? Something competitive. Not with all the bells and whistles, but enough to get you going. It just depends on what you're into. You know what I mean? You kind of have options. I think before, if you wanted to take the cheap route, you went with Japanese cars because they were so much cheaper. But now, you know, here we are, you know, 2026, you can find just about anything if you look hard enough. There's plenty of like 90s and 2000s chassis from the American side and from the Japanese side you can get into. You can put something together if you can use a wrench, and you have the know-how. So it's definitely a different time, and it's very interesting because I'm curious to see which one will sort of prosper and which one will kind of slow down. But right now, it seems like they're pretty even though, on both sides.
I don't think we're gonna see either one beat out the other one. I truly think that we're just gonna kind of get to this point where, instead of I know coming up for us, it was always the import versus domestic versus Euro. Like, it was always that segregated kind of battle of the bands type thing going on. But I feel like now it's becoming more of, if it works for you, let's do it. Let's see. You know, it's become a lot more homogenous where, you know, even though I'm a big Ford head, as I've said, there's one Corvette that I always take, and I want to see 6Z06 before I die. I love that car. I've driven a couple of them. There's just something about them that's so intoxicating. Yeah. But I also will always have my Nissans, always have that side and my Ford side of it, but I will pick that one car up. So I don't think it's really as much as it used to be where it was like, oh no, I only mess with Hondas. I will never own a Ford. I'll never have a Mustang. Where you can have the guy who's got a S550 Mustang and a Civic Type R both sitting in the driveway, and that's completely acceptable now. So
yeah, it seems like it. I mean, I think drift has a big part to do with that, with people putting LS engines into Japanese chassis. And I think on the street, people that were at the time brave enough to put Japanese wheels on American cars, which, you know, was kind of unheard of for forever, right? And then all of a sudden it started popping up everywhere. And now you see, import style wheels used on Porsche and, you know, Mustang, everything really, BMWs, all that stuff. So it's become acceptable. We've had the chance to see things go from a very cut and dry, either you're import or domestic, there's no in between.
Yep.
Right. To sort of a blending of cultures, right? And yep. All the way over the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years. I don't know, how old are you, 21? Anyways, over the last couple decades, right? Right. So we've seen that, right? So now I wonder what's going to happen from now, looking ahead 10, 15, 20 years, because now you have you have an okay amount of enthusiast vehicles that are available right now. From the Corvettes and I guess some of the Mustangs, GR Corolla, we mentioned that before, 86 BRZ, Civic Type R, all those vehicles that are currently available right now,
yep.
How are they going to look in 15 to 20 years? Are people going to want to pick those up, maybe swap them with something, whatever is available at that time, hop them up and build them? Is there going to be that there? Or is it going to be that people are still going to be looking for 90s chassis and trying to find them, which they're probably going to be worth tons by then, I would imagine. You're going to find a 95 Civic that, it's beat to crap and they're selling for 15 grand or something because, it's so much later,
It's going to be like when you buy them, it's going to be like when you're buying a late 60s, early 70s car today. Oh, yeah, 100%. I think it's going to be, we're just going to see that same thing because it started, you can go back to pre-war brass cars and there's a there was collectors of that and it just continued to grow, went through the muscle car era, went through, hot rod era, muscle car era, 80s, hot, 80s muscle cars, which aren't really muscle cars.
Yeah,
and now, but I'm saying it's always been this continuous march. And it's really cool because I think that the fact that I can appreciate cars going back to the hot rods and the brass cars and things like that, and then going forward, appreciate those cars. It would be really cool to see like what my grandkids, if cars are still a thing at that point, do they have how far does that appreciation for the art form of the automobile go back? Like, so there is that. Right. I do have that little bit of hope that, like, I'll be having a conversation with my grandkid about my 90s car, and they're like, wow, that's old, which is fine, but it's still cool. Like, when you get to sit there and you're talking to the guy who's got the 69, Boss 302 sitting in his garage,
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mentioned to a friend just recently, we were talking about, future generations and people that are going to be building cars in the future, and hopefully there's going to be a lot of people to pick up on it and it doesn't just completely fall by the wayside. But one thing I mentioned, I go, what if in 15, 20 years, something like a Tesla is still going strong and there's much more powerful, capable motors in those vehicles, and people start buying or start wanting the Teslas from this era in order to, to swap in motor, what is there going to be that too? Because you have to think, right now the EV stuff slowed down a bit, but it's still there. It's still going to be a thing.
Yeah.
What if it takes over, right? In 15, 20 years, that's the thing. EV is all you can get. There could be people actually doing, buying a cheap Tesla that's got a dead battery or a dead motor now or from this era, and then swap it in, something newer, something even more modern. That'd be crazy because it'd be completely, kind of against what we see now. But at the same time, maybe that's all that's going to be available at that time.
Yeah. So. I mean, we did have Travis Reeder. I don't know if you remember. He had that Mustang with the. I'm sorry. Wow. Woo. Take that back. The Camaro with the electric drive motors in it. So it's interesting to see. And then you got the guy with the Tesla that has the LS motor in it. And then you got the guys with the BMW i3 that are putting gas engines in it. So I don't think it's going to matter. I think if there's a power plant and a chassis, somebody is going to find a way to make them work together. Whether it doesn't matter. It's just one of those things that I think that is just, we're gearheads. And, you know, I've said it before that this is just modern hot rodding. I know that it's whether you're into imports, whether you're into domestics, whether you're into Euro cars, it's still hot rodding. It's that quintessential, I want to take what's there, make it cool, make it better, put my own spin on it, whatever it is. It's that cultural thing. And I don't think that even if in 20 years they're doing it to a Tesla, if it makes any difference, because I think they're still going to find a way to do their own spin on it, their own, you know, twist. And, you know, let's hope that they're pulling out gas engines and throwing them in them and we're still having that fun. You know, maybe we won't be running on gasoline. Maybe it'll be an alcohol-based fuel or something like that. Yeah. But who knows? But let's see where that goes.
Or maybe the way that we look at old carbureted engines, like, man, that's so ancient. You should really be fuel injected. They'll be looking at like, do you know those guys used to use gas? Put fuel in their cars?
Listen, like, guys looking at us strangely because we're still talking about port injection when they're getting power out of DI. So it's there. Sure. Like the technology is just marching and it's going to get to a point where we got the next, you know, we have the next ideation of what's going on, and then we'll adapt. You know, I don't think we've ever stopped. I think that's what's really cool about the car game, you know, whatever you want to say, is that as technology's improved, we've kind of just rolled with it and continue to make better parts or make better products or do something, you know, make cars faster, make them handle better, whatever it is. We've always just continued to march that on. And going back to the whole muscle car thing, having muscle cars that are now, as you said, they're handling like the European cars or like the imports used to. So it's really cool to see that progression across the board with them.
Yeah, I think even when things slowed down, you know, we were getting hit hard by, well, at least in California, you know, by CARB and things like that. We're slowing down really everything because, you know, everything's illegal here. You can't really modify anything. Even in the face of that, I mean, things still went on, right? Though we're probably more advanced now than we have been in any other era, any other point, whether it be import or domestic. I don't know how that looks in the future. I mean, if it gets tighter, you know, it's like I said, very, very tough to modify stuff out here and still be okay to drive it. Or, you know, sneak around a bit. But, you know, like you said, there's going to be people that are building stuff and tinkering no matter what. There's going to be diehards no matter what. And I think it's kind of our job as parents also to sort of at least try to pass that down a little bit. I don't try to force anything on my kids. I do, you know, explain stuff in the car world. They do have questions and, you know, I explain it to the best I can. You know, they have questions about my car sometimes. They don't really seem to be all that into it, but they're still very young. You know, maybe when they turn 16, 17, it'll be a different story.
My son's probably watching this podcast. So that's usually what happens is I'll get home. He'll be like, oh, I like that one. That was a good one. So yeah, usually he's fact checking us on his end. So
there you go. Let us know below, you know, if what your thoughts are in terms of the whole import and domestic thing. Have you also noticed sort of this uptick in the number of muscle cars, of American cars in the drift world, and your cars and coffee, your car shows, things like that? It seems like they really are increasing quite a bit. And that sort of that melding, the mixing of both the import and domestic, it's the lines are completely blurred now. So I don't know, sky's the limit, it seems like. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, no. And it's great because, as I said, coming up down south, I got to live that blended, you know, that blended lifestyle, let's say, you know. So it's cool to see that it's kind of become the norm.
Yeah, that's really cool. So that's all I got, man. I just wanted to chit chat a little bit. Yeah. That's it. We'll catch you on the next one. Okay.